My name is Seth Winter. Can everyone hear me? Okay. How about now? Okay. Mr. Owen, by the way, is doing much better. It wasn't as serious as we thought. He'll be back at work next week. The title of my program is called A Tribute to Edward J. Smith with a big question mark after it. Those of you who have who have collected records for years, especially in the operatic era, remember those famous EJS records, Unique Opera Records, Anna, and as well as a number of other discs he put out. The reason why I'm calling it A Tribute to Edward J. Smith question mark is that I found the original source from where Eddie Smith was taking everything from, mostly the Metropolitan Opera material. And what I'd like to do is start off, as Joe Pierce of the Vocal Record Collector Society in New York, who I belong to, says, what I always want to hear is a good dequel appearer. We'll start with one which is announced. Was the Metropolitan Opera broadcast of January 11th, 1941. The soprano you heard was Norena Greco. Of course, that was Mr. Buehrling. The beginning you heard was from an Eddie Smith record. What you heard as the dequel appear started was what the original tape source sounded like. So when I say a tribute to Eddie Smith, I say it with a big question mark. Now, a lot of people told me, well, when you give this program, he said, now be nice to Eddie. He put out a lot of stuff. He put out a lot of things that no one ever knew about. But he did it in a rather, how could I say, slipshod manner. He was not known for doing well productions. I found the gentleman who had worked with him. He said he used to cut on the Scully lathes themselves. He wouldn't even pay for the engineer. Used to cram as much as 40 minutes aside, which you have to alter the sound in order to do something like that. And he was, in fact, so cheap that he didn't even bother putting them into plastic-covered sleeves. He used to get them in paper sleeves. There was never any production work done on any of this. His attitude was, they ought to be lucky the way they're getting it. Now, the history of where these things came from was that back about 1956-57, NBC had decided that they were going to throw out all their transcription discs that they had taken down. As early as 1936, NBC and RCA were cutting 16-inch lacquers of all broadcasts that were going over the air. The Metropolitan, of course, was carried by WJZ, which was an NBC-RCA affiliate. There were a series of approximately six disc cutters running at the same time in three pairs. They were called A, B, and C copies, reference copies. The A copy was one that generally had all announcements from beginning to end, including intermissions. The B copy had all the music, but missing most of the commentary. In other words, just a reference for the music. The C copy, which started about 1940, 41, were the Spanish-American announcement ones, which were rebroadcast that had an announcer who was sitting in the booth next to Milton Cross during the performance, announcing in Spanish, and that was sent to another set of disc cutters. What RCA did at the time was that they decided they didn't need the duplicate sources. They put on the discs for discard, and a whole ton of them were thrown out about 1957-58. The friend of mine was able to get in there and borrow these things and able to tape them. In fact, he told me, you wouldn't believe what some of the discs looked like. You pulled them out and you would see coffee cup stains on them. They were using them as coffee tables over there. And it's the type of thing where he couldn't take the disc because they said, no, we have to throw it away. And he said it was like with tears in his eyes, he'd bring the disc back, hand it to them, and watch them throw it into the dumpster. The earliest discs, he told me, were from the 1936-37 season. Those were the most problematic of all the discs I came across. Irwin had recorded them on any kind of tape he could find. In fact, I'll pass around two of them just to show you. There are a number of things that complicated matters with these tapes. Firstly, 1956 was the beginning of Mylar, so you do have some of them like that. But they also had acetate-based tapes, which unfortunately have curled over the years, which I've been trying to restore. Not only to complicate the matters, he made his own dubs on tape more recently, and then took all the tapes and threw them in the back of his basement, which developed the mold problem. Three quarters of the boxes I had to throw out and relabel everything and then clean the mold off the tape. So I'm up against an awful lot of problems here. I'll pass these around. Please, these must come back. These are my originals. This will show you the condition of the tape. The tapes I'm sending around, one is, I think, the 41 Otello, one reel of it. Those are Mylar, the early Mylar. The other one is the Nozze di Figaro from 1940, the March 9th performance. He ran into all sorts of problems dubbing these things. Some of them have residual hum, which I'm able to take out. But getting back to what happened with the earliest known discs from this collection, which was from 1936, was that the lacquers were not aluminum-based or glass-based, they were steel-based. They hadn't developed a good way of doing aluminum. And I asked him, what was it like carrying it? He said, well, you had to work out like Jack LaLanne in order to carry the damn things back and forth because they were so heavy. The problems I incurred in those first seasons were that the disc cutters were running at all sorts of crazy speeds. Even size would be running at about half tone down from where they should be. Odd size would be running about a half tone up. Sometimes the speed would change in the middle of a note, which had to be compensated. You're also working off a problem whereby everything was dubbed on fairly decent equipment, but not professionally, whereby certain problems had to be corrected. Inside-outside compensation, where the inside of the disc sounded duller than the outside because they were using instead of heated styli, they were using burnished styli. We ran into all sorts of problems. Now, the thing was, my friend Irwin did lend these things to Eddie Smith, and that's where Smith got a lot of his material. Not only Metropolitan Opera, some Covent Garden material, certain broadcasts. I think there was a Montemezzi piece, a premiere with the NBC Symphony in 1943 he had found. Smith was And the true word of the, is the sense of the word, as we say in Brooklyn, a shyster. He was putting out a product as fast as he could, but he did serve a purpose. You did find out about certain performances, combinations of singers that had never gone into the studio to do anything. I have another excerpt. This one is from the 1943 Nozze di Figaro from April 17th with Ezio Pinzer and Paul Breisach conducting. These are off glass-based discs, and this is with the South American source, meaning the alternate source that was sent down to either Portugal, I think it was Portugal. No, these were for rebroadcast. They sent the discs down, and they would broadcast it with these announcements on them. Let me play it for you.
Non più avrai questi bei pennacchi, quel cappello leggero galante, quella chioma, quell'aria brillante, quel vermiglio d'onesto color, quel vermiglio d'onesto color. Non più avrai quei pennacchi, quel cappello, quella chioma, quell'aria brillante. E non ti avrai corpo nuovo e amoroso, occhi sol, occhi sol, occhi l'acqua, quelle belle quando hai riposo, narcisetta, narcino d'amore. Quelle belle quando hai riposo, narcisetta, narcino d'amore. Acqua il piedi, poppa il pacco, acqua stacco, secco il sacco, scoppi sparco, scavano il fianco, collo dritto, muso franco, gran casco, gran turbante, molto lor, poco contante, poco contante, poco contante. Ed invece del fandango, una marcia per il fango, per montagne e per balloni, con le nevi e i soglioni, al concerto di tromboni, di bombarde e di cannoni, e le palle in tutti i tuoni, all'orecchio fa fischiare. Non ti avrai, pretenda chi, non ti avrai, non ti avrai, corpo duro e amoroso, otto giorni, otto giorni, otto giorni, quelle belle, quando hai riposo, narcisetta, narcino d'amore. Quelle belle, quando hai riposo, narcisetta, narcino d'amore. Che viva la vittoria, alla gloria di Vitor, e vino alla vittoria, alla gloria di Vitor, alla gloria di Vitor, alla gloria di Vitor.
Acto de la ópera Las bodas de Fígaro de Mozart. Y aquí salen a saludar Ezio Pinza, Vidu Sayao, Germila Novotna, Alessio De Paolis, Salvatore Bacaloni y John Brownlee. Han salido a saludar el reparto completo. John Brownlee, Vidus Ayao, Ezio Pinza, Germila Novotna, Alessio De Paolis y Salvatore Bacaloni, y aquí salen a saludar una vez más. Y así, amables oyentes, termina el primer acto de la ópera Las Bodas de Fígaro. Ahora hacemos una breve pausa para identificar nuestra estación.
That was the South American source. Now, the problem is, with what survived over at the NBC vaults, a lot of this material was shipped down to the Library of Congress for storage. In the interim, something like this, I would surmise, though I'm not sure, probably does not exist anymore concerning those discs because they were glass-based. Now, as of 1941, when we entered World War II, aluminum was very short in supply. The lacquers were used a base of glass, because of the fact that there was no aluminum around. Erwin had told me that when he was going through the dubs, as early as 1940, there was a Lucia with Lily Pons that was on glass-based discs already. And it wasn't because of a shortage. They felt that the glass-based discs were much quieter in the cutting method. There was one problem with that when he put it together. He said one of the discs was completely broken. He had to take something off the air to patch it with it, and he says it's just like night and day when you compare them. Currently, I am putting these things together, repitching them, splicing them, and I'm offering them to the Metropolitan Opera for their use for their archive for the historic broadcasts. If anybody wants to get in contact with me, I'd be more than happy to help out. If I can help anybody out looking for things, or if we can accumulate things that the Met is looking or I'm looking for, it'd be most appreciative. Does anyone have any questions? All right, we'll start there.
Okay, well, two things about the base of the discs. The first glass-based discs were shipped from Audio Devices and from Presto around April of 1941. Anything before that would have been purely experimental.
That's what it was.
The word from Presto is not that the discs were quieter, but that that was flat, and that it was easier to make a flat disc, especially for cutting purposes for pressings. So it is true that they were making them before we got into the war. As far as the steel-based discs in 1936, they really couldn't have been steel-based. They were just a heavier gauge. The discs from around 1934 through 37 weigh about 1 3/4 pounds.
Already.
After that, the Q-lacquer discs, they started using a slightly thinner gauge. They weigh about 1 1/4 pounds. If you put a steel-based disc with a magnetic cutter or a magnetic pickup, the pickup just gets pulled right to the disc.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use a steel base. The only time steel base was used was during World War II, but by then it was used for only home cutters, and most home cutters used crystal cutters. But if you try to play one of those with a magnetic
pickup, it would get stuck, yes.
From that era, you end up with a tracking weight about twice to three times the amount of what. I once put a steel based disc on an old RCA table, not knowing it, and I almost couldn't pull the arm off the record. So it probably was not steel.
All right, then I'm correct. It was just a heavier gauge of aluminum they were using. Yes, sir. Pardon me?
What was destroyed?
The discs that were dubbed onto these tapes. These were the duplicate copies. In other words, what were called the B or the C copies. In other words, they were running out of room, and they just took these things and just threw them into a dumpster and said, good riddance.
Second, I'm with the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
There are a few of the glass discs broken, but not the majority.
Mm-hmm.
They are in generally amazingly good condition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Michael?
Yeah.
Have you done some studies? Did you find the
Spanish? In the case of World War II, we shouldn't forget that the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, which was run by Nelson Rockefeller, undertook to a large extent the distribution of these musical programs to South America. So the Voice of America, which obtained those discs after the war when the Coordinator of Inter-American Awareness was shut down, obtained dubs or copies. I know in some cases we actually had the C copies, the actual discs themselves, or a copy of the C copy, which was the Spanish copy. I should also point out that in some cases there are Portuguese announcements with these broadcasts.
That's correct, too, right.
Not necessarily the Met, but certainly the NBC Symphony.
Yes, well, the NBC Symphony is interesting because they use the separate microphone in the hall. And theoretically, the story is because they were 10 feet away from the regular NBC mic. If you could sync one on one channel and the other, you would get either a binaural or stereotype sound. But good luck trying to do it because the pitch would wander all over the place. let me see. Yes, sir.
Is it true that E.J. Smith used to take these recordings? Mm-hmm. If he had a section missing, he would take an entirely different performance?
Yes, definitely. Yes, yes. There are many of his records that are attributed to certain singers, and they're not. For example, there's supposed to be a Tuska with Helga Rusfinger from Europe from 1946. It turned out to be Rudolf Schock. Rusfinger never did a broadcast of it. There's also the famous 1926 Covent Garden Otello with Zenitello. How did he combine it? He took two performances, the Melba Farewell and the Zenitello, and put the whole thing together and dubbed in from the commercial HMV set at the time. So the Iago is going between Noto and Granforte every other measure. But he was able to filter the sound that you couldn't hear the splices or the voices change that much because he had scrunched the sound so badly. Oh, well, he was the first.
The premiere.
Yes, sir.
He produced on Anna Records,
yeah.
Supposedly a Smirnoff recital.
Oh, yes, the one on the paper records. Yes, I've got that thing.
Which is probably Michal Exandovich.
Yes, there was also a story, he said it may have been Davidoff or someone like that.
No.
Yeah, I have that record. Yeah, I have that record. Yes, sir.
Yeah, with the Met broadcast, what roughly are the inclusive dates of the material you have? Is it more or less continuous, or are there gaps?
Oh, there are big gaps in there. I know it starts with the first broadcast of December 26, 36, which was the Maison Vettigrin, Samson and Delilah, and that season is pretty much complete, right through to the end of, I think it went to May 15, 37, which was a mignon with either Gladys Swarthout or Jenny Terrell. There was one with Swarthout, I think a month or two earlier. It then gets very shaky along the way, but then I think there's a complete season somewhere, I think in 40, 41. That season, I think, survives fairly complete.
Did Smith issue more or less all the things?
No, there was a 1943 Don Giovanni that was from Chicago. The reason why he didn't issue that was the next to the last disc was missing. So you don't get the supper scene at all. It comes in the middle of the final scene. There was also a Traviata, which was Jan Pierce's debut, November 29th, 1941, with, Novotna, he never put out complete. There are scads of these things. He also got kind of tired of saying, another Die Walküre walking through the door, how many am I going to put out on these things? How many am I going to sell? So he would generally pick the best one and put that out, and that would be the one he would be selling. Trying to think if there was anything else. Of course, I met Smith. The greatest line he pulled at the VRCS was the story of how he got from a Dutch sea captain, an acetate copy of a cylinder conducted by Wagner himself. And he got up in front of the VRCS and tells this story, and he said, I got a stipulation from this Dutch sea captain, you know, it sounds like a story from the Flying Dutchman of all things, that upon his death, the acetate is to be copied and sold at $1 a piece on acetate copies. Well, Mr. Smith's been dead now, I think, 3 or 4 years, and Mr. Bill Violi, who used to distribute Eddie's stuff, everyone keeps ripping Bill every time. They say, Bill, I got my dollar. Where's the record? Oh, he also said that there was purportedly, I don't know if it's anything true, about an Otello with Lawrence Melchior and Beecham from Covent Garden, I think from 1938, that he said he was trying to negotiate from the BBC to put out. There was something else, too, he said about that Wagner acetate. He said that's how he met Toscanini. Toscanini came, he wanted to hear that, and he spent the whole afternoon with the maestro, and he said about the whole afternoon, and I checked that out, and from what I understand, maestro never even met him or even knew who he was. He was notorious, let's put it that way. Yes, sir.
Is that
Yeah. Okay.
I had dealings with Walter Toscanini and discussed with him at one time very briefly.
Yeah.
I worked doing some of Eddie's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then Walter came down and was doing some stuff with him and discussed with Walter some of the EJS peccadilloes.
Peccadilly?
which he was already aware of to a certain extent, and which he led me to believe his father already had some information about. Of course, the general atmosphere was one of, no, we've got to get the pitch right, we can't do what some of these other people do. And this was a prime example, but an example which I'm reasonably sure was known to us community, at least secondhand.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you for correcting me on that. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
There was a fellow in the suburbs of Philadelphia named Byron Hathaway.
Oh, yes. He's out of the business now. He apparently had put out a list that listed excerpts from Met broadcasts as early as 1932, I think.
That's right. There was one with Hayashi with Martinelli and the Rita Greco and Lawrence Tibbetts.
Well, that would be 1941, I think.
No, it was in the early 30s.
Could have been. He also purportedly had the Act Two of Norma with Poncel, I think, that they only broadcast the second act of or something.
You know what happened?
A friend of mine wrote to him and got back a letter. He got the catalog back, and he put a letter, and he says, I am no longer in the tape business. That's it. We don't know.
You know why?
No, I don't.
Byron Hathaway sang with the Philadelphia Opera Company and also sang in Lightfield with the Sullivan Brothers around the Philadelphia urban area. And he had a very gorgeous and pretty soprano wife, who unfortunately was like Medan Pagliacci. So,
what was her name?
They always, they had two children, and one fine Sunday morning about 8 or 10 years ago, they were coming out of the church, and Byron shot her, killed her immediately.
Oh.
He was doing lifetime,
I think that also happened to the gentleman who put out MRF records. He went after the guy he was living with and like stabbed him and stabbed all the, I think he had killed the man in a rage and then like went through with the knife and started stabbing through all the boxes of stock, and they let him off on something like a charge of insanity. I think that was MRF records, which was a pirate back in the late 60s, early 70s. The guy's name was Bismarck, I think.
Like a flea market with a whole bunch of dealers, and I was walking through there about 2 years ago, and I saw a whole bunch of paperwork, and they were operatic scores, and with his name stamped on each one. I spoke to the proprietor, and I said, well, what happened to the tapes and the records in this collection? And nobody knew a thing about it.
Uh-huh. All righty. Yes, sir.
Question, what does MRF stand for? I have some MRF.
I have absolutely no idea.
Mario Sambuget.
Bouget.
Yeah. But you go to glass based.
Well, I don't work off the disc. Those tapes that went around is what I have to work off of now.
Is anyone trying to make fresh transfers?
Yes, the Metropolitan Opera has a series whereby they're trying to preserve the historic broadcasts on cassette for people to come and listen to at the New York Public Library. I'm working with them concerning different sources. We're using state-of-the-art over there. We're using a Technics SP15 variable pitch turntable with an SME tone arm, the OWL multi-filter and the OWL 1, Packburn when it has to be used, the Urey Little Dipper, and we're making the masters on Atari, the Atari 5050 decks, and then transferring down, I think we're using a Tascam three-head cassette deck. All right, can I? Oh, okay. All right, well, thank you, everyone. If you want to get in contact with...